Hello, and welcome to My Cape York Life, stories from the people who live on and care for Cape York Peninsula.
I've lived here at Shipton's Flat all my life. I'm the third generation of us here, actually. Our family has lived here for about a century or a bit better, I guess.
It was incredibly remote in those days. The bitumen used to end at Mount Carbine. And, you know, it was a fair trek just getting to Palmer River.
Kutan's almost like an island. You forget it when you're here, but to go anywhere else, you've got a long drive. So we're pretty, as a group of people, we're pretty resilient. We can make do with things.
Everything's exaggerated when you're in isolated areas. So yeah. Everything sort of becomes a drama and just because of distance and nothing's easy. And But, it certainly teaches you to cope with all sorts of situations.
Yeah, it becomes part of life.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you've ever been to the Cape, or if you're planning your Cape York adventure here one day, this podcast is for you. And it's for people who care about the health of this beautiful place, and people who care for country. Spread the word, tell your friends. You can download earlier episodes of My Cape York Life from your favourite podcast app, or you can stream it from Cape York Land Manager on Cape York NRM's website. This episode of My Cape York Life takes us to Marpoon on the northwest coast of the Cape. It's a challenging 900-kilometre drive from Cairns, or 90 kilometres north of Weipa, along a coast road that takes you through some spectacular tropical savanna country. Marpoon is a small town, home to about 300 people, and until recently, one of them was Louise Stone. Louise was the Land and Sea Coordinator of the Marpoon Land and Sea Ranger Group. Louise worked with the Marpoon Ranger Group, protecting endangered turtles that nest in the area. There's also a huge number of migratory birds to monitor, and she helps keep a keen eye on the dugong, the cow of the sea that loves chewing on seagrass. We're having a chat on the banks of the beautiful Janey Creek. The breeze is blowing, the fish are jumping, and Louise is sharing her wonderful stories.
Janey Creek is south of Marpoon, about 14, 15 kilometres south of Marpoon, and it's sort of borders one of the main beaches where we do our turtle research.
And what does it look like here?
Oh, beautiful. Mangroves, sand, beautiful. Just excellent clean water, wide rivers, lots of mangroves, lush vegetation, beautiful sand.
We're at the mouth of the Janey, and across from where we're sitting, I can see we've got...
Flinders.
What's that over there?
Flinders Beach.
And what's all the equipment I'm seeing?
Oh, well, that's buggies and quad bikes that we've been using for the turtle research for the last month, because we spend a month out here each August researching and monitoring flatbacks and olive ridleys.
Okay.
As part of our work program.
Okay. Louise, you grew up on the Tablelands. Were you born on the Tablelands?
I was. I was born in Atherton, actually, and spent sort of most of my young life on a dairy farm just outside of Malanda, which was great. Just the best way to grow up, I reckon.
And what kinds of things did you do? What's life like for a kid on the Tablelands?
Fun, like when I grew up, because we were out in the bush, we had horses, you know, you had freedom, you could go anywhere, do what you wanted to do. Nobody worried about safety or, you know, shutting doors or locking windows. It just didn't enter your head. We'd get on horses on, you know, Saturday morning and just leg it for the day, just go. Take a Vegemite sandwich, as kids do, which usually ended up soggy, and just explore and adventure all over the place. You know, you could go on other people's properties because their kids were doing the same. So we just roamed around, had a great time. Built cubby houses and all sorts of weirdo stuff.
And your family were dairy farmers?
Yeah, dairy farmers.
And so that would be pretty hard life?
It certainly was for the parents. I mean, I think as kids we sort of, you know, we had the best of it. But I know Mum and Dad just worked so hard their whole life, you know, to give us. We weren't rich people, but we never went without anything. That was good.
And I imagine the place where you're talking about was, did you say somewhere around Malanda?
Yeah, outside of Malanda, up the top end towards Topaz there. So pretty wet.
Pretty wet there.
Very wet. Yeah, which is probably one reason I ended up in the Cape. You get sick of the rain and drizzle, but still it was beautiful. It needs that sort of water to keep the green lush going on.
But knee-high in mud most days.
Most days, nearly every day. I remember as kids, we never woke up thinking, oh, it's going to be a sunny day. Just, again, you didn't think about it. And the old saying was that it rained 9 months of the year and then the wet season starts. So, yeah, very wet. Up to 4 metres a year sort of thing. So, very wet.
Yeah. And it must have been pretty difficult getting cows in weather like that, or they just went with the flow?
No, cows are good like that. You sort of get them into a routine and they know what time milking is and they'll start wandering down themselves. But I can remember as a kid going out with Dad to get the cows in for the morning milk. So it'd be about 4 o'clock in the morning and cold and wet and horrible. So as a kid, it was great. Dad would boot a cow out of the way and put me in the warm patch on the ground and then just leave me there till he'd come back because it was all warm and dry. It was great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Louise, did you have a big family?
Five of us. I'm the youngest of five. So I've got one sister who's the eldest and three brothers in the middle. Well, we all had chores. You all had to do chores. It was always farm work. We didn't really do much in the house. But yeah, we always had chores to do and each person had their own thing to do.
Yeah.
Every day after school, etc. We sold the dairy farm. We didn't actually leave the tablelands, but we sold the dairy farm in Malanda and the parents bought a beef property just outside of Ravensay. So I spent a couple of years at high school there and then moved, left home.
Then left home?
Yeah.
And where did you go to? Where did you end up?
Charters Towers, of all places.
And what did you do?
Oh, I did another year of school there. Mm-hmm. And then the person I was with, they got transferred down to Mergen. So I moved down to Mergen and that's when I left school and sort of started getting a real job.
As a young kid on the tablelands, had you seen much of the world before that, or had you?
No, not really. I'd been to Brisbane, I think, once.
Yep.
I think it was about the 70s somewhere. I went to Brisbane, and that's about it. Well, it was bigger than anything I sort of used to. I mean, it was still it's a fairly farming sort of area anyway, peanuts and all that sort of stuff. It was back then. So, I mean, it was a lot drier. The country was a bit different, but it was still really a country town, Mergen, at that stage.
Yep.
Yeah.
And what was your first job?
Babysitting kids for the principal of the school that I'd left, actually.
Okay.
And that was just sort of a fill-in thing. It was a bit of a hoot. And then started nursing out at Cherbourg at the hospital out there. About 8 months, 9 months or something like that.
Yep.
Yeah. It was good. I really enjoyed it, but very sad. Yeah, very sad. Yeah, no, just too sad when you're watching babies die through just sheer neglect. No, I can't do this. And there's nothing you can do to change it, so.
Yeah.
And as a kid, I was only like 17 or 18 or something at the time. I thought, no, I'm out of here. Yeah, don't want this.
Yeah.
Okay. But it was a good experience. I don't regret it. It was a great experience.
And from Mergen, did you travel for a bit?
No. Well, you travelled and worked all the time because you could back then. There was plenty of work. You know, if you wanted a job, you could get it. So it was easy just to jump on a bus or a train or whatever and go somewhere else and get another job.
Mm.
I think after that I ended up down in Brisbane. My sister and her old man had a transport company down there, so I used to go down there during the week and drive trucks and then go back to Mergen on the weekends.
And eventually you found yourself back up?
I did.
On the tablelands?
Back up on the tablelands, living in a house about 200 metres up the road from where I was born kind of thing. Grew up.
Yeah.
I just got back from working out at Gunpowder, which is a little mining town just down on the Northern Territory border, west of Mount Isa. So I'd come back to town, was just doing a bit of cleaning around the place, and then got a job at Lotus Glen, the prison.
Mm. And what were you doing? What was the job?
It was called sentence management, which sort of you're responsible for, like their parole dates and court dates, things like that, and also the educational programs that they were going to undertake while they were in there. It was really good because you actually worked with the prisoners, you're in there with them, and it was good. Most of them were just normal, average blokes who just happened to have a bit of bad luck. I mean, there were some nasties too, but generally they were just, yeah, average people.
So, Lou, you told us about a bit of a story once before about you jumping in a wagon with your sister and heading off on some adventure. Do you want to tell us about that? What brought it about?
Well, it was my sister's idea, because my sister's crazy. She's even crazier than I am.
Where were you living at the time?
Ravensay, because they'd moved back, and I must have just been visiting or something. I can't even remember how it came about, but Margaret had this idea that, because I think Margaret was born in the wrong century, you know, she should have been born way back in the Wild West or something like that, I reckon. So she had this dream that she wanted to travel in a horse and cart around the place, and so that's what we did. We got a bread cart, it was an old bread cart from Brisbane, and we modified it, turned it into a covered wagon, you know, like you see on the movies with the steamed, you know, bows and all that sort of stuff. And then, yeah, we took off from Ravensow with her, her hubby. I think there was three kids at the time. Yeah, I think three kids at the time.
And where did
a couple
you go?
Of dogs. Oh, out through Garnet and down through the middle of Queensland. Pretty much, not through, you know, down through Bohemia Downs, all that sort of way.
So you all travelled in this wagon?
No, we had horses. Margaret and I had riding horses, and the older kids had riding horses. And Bob sort of, you know, took care of the wagon, and we'd go ahead and scout, try and find a campsite, water, whatever.
Yeah. And so how far would you travel in a day, do you reckon?
Oh, it depends. Yeah, maybe sometimes only 20k, sometimes 30k, because it's all about the horses.
Yep. It was about just getting out and...
just having a look.
Yep. And how long did you do that for?
Well, about 18 months.
Wow. And the kids were with you?
Yeah, yeah. Margaret had a baby along the way.
Oh, wow.
Yep. No, the kids were only little. They were, I think one was school age and the other two weren't school age yet. No, the kids still talk about it today, not always fondly. Narelle says if, you know, if she ever has to see Rice again, she's going to kill people. But, yeah, you know, they still, you know, they enjoyed the adventure.
Yeah. Yeah,
it was good.
And, I mean, you're pretty resourceful. I imagine you're a pretty resourceful kind of person, and I imagine your older sister is much the same.
Yeah.
So you just pulled up somewhere along the way, found a spot where you could camp. And
yeah, water was the main thing. You find a spot, you could camp, and... we had sort of dry supplies with us, you know, your standard flour, sugar, all that sort of thing, tin food and stuff.
Yep.
But go out, you'd, you know, get a beast or something, or kill something, or go fishing, whatever.
Yeah. And did you work along the way?
Yeah, yeah. Do a bit of singing along the way, and my sister used to do a bit of fencing or ringing, and my brother-in-law used to make the best bread. So, and station owners and people like that were really, really generous. Like, they were just gobsmacked to see this Beverly Hillbillies type arrangement. Come cruising into their station, it's like, what the? So, but people were really good, really welcoming.
Because it is quite a picture that you can paint in your mind when you think about that, and you've got this wagon.
Yeah, it was beautiful Clydesdale that was pulling it. It was just gorgeous.
What colour was he?
Brown and white, yeah, brown typical white. Clydesdale, you know, feathery feet and all that.
Yeah,
Troopy was his name, he was great.
Yeah. So I'd just like to... pick up on that bit. You said you played a bit of music along the way, so you're, you've got a bit of a musical background.
Oh, I have done a bit in the past, yeah.
Yeah. So do you want to tell us about that?
Well, I don't do it anymore.
Sure. Yeah.
But no, I don't know, music's always been my thing. Even as a kid, I could just pick up an instrument and play it. Doesn't matter what it is, I can play it, get a tune out of it within about 20 minutes usually. I don't know, as a kid, I used to just sing and everybody thought it was all right, so it just become something that I did, really. And then as I got a bit older, sort of teenage-y, people started paying me, which was very cool. So that was, I guess, the biggest incentive to keep singing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, people started paying me, and music's always kind of been a part of my life. I've been in bands and done tours and travelled around the place. And it's, like I say, it's always a good way to make money.
Yeah. And you've performed with some famous people along the way.
Oh, maybe Semi.
Semi, yeah.
Oh, probably the...
some known people, certainly.
Yeah, probably the one I remember the most was a lady by the name of Esther King.
Mm.
And she was the female vocalist in the Platters.
Mm.
And she came over to Australia on her own doing some tours around, and I got asked to travel around with her, which was... that was really good. It was most amazing.
Yeah, so where did you go?
A lovely
what
woman.
Kind of places
all around southeast Brisbane, southeast Queensland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's a lovely woman?
Absolutely beautiful woman.
Yeah.
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah. And where would you say she was from the States?
Yeah.
The Platters were a pretty big thing.
They were.
Yeah.
So and this was years later, of course, you know.
Yeah. But nonetheless, it still must have been quite an experience.
It was. No, it was very good. Just to sort of, you learn off people like that because they're so professional. I mean, I was just I just opened me gob and sound come out. But for these sort of people, it's a real lifetime thing.
Yeah. So... what kinds of things did you learn? Would you have learned, for instance?
Oh, just, I guess, a bit more about the showmanship of it, you know, and how to organise if you're going to do concerts and tours, just, you know, a bit about the organisation and, you know, even down to song lists and things like that, how to organise what first, what next, what, you know, what after that. So it was good.
So you found yourself back on the Tablelands,
mm-hmm.
working in a prison.
Yep. actually it was before the prison. I was working with Eachamshire, planting trees. It's what was called then the Wet Tropics Tree Planting Scheme, which come about with all the National Heritage stuff come through. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so they started all these gangs from Townsville up to Cooktown to basically retrain ex-timber workers into green jobs. So for whatever reason, I ended up there. And then after that, went away, come back, ended up at the prison. And it was then I got a phone call from a lady down in Cairns called Sue Vise, who was CEO of the North Queensland Joint Board, and they were the broker for all the funding. And she said, oh, you want to come down and coordinate our training? I went, yeah, okay. So that's how I ended up there.
And so you were training, and what were you training?
Land management stuff. I mean, they call it conservation land management now, but back then it was just land management generally.
So what did that involve when you were a trainer for that?
Well, I sort of got... It wasn't sort of my intention or my career. I just happened to have a piece of paper. In those days it was called instructional skills. So the company needed somebody with a qualification that could go and deliver training. So, like I said, it wasn't something I'd planned to do, but I just happened to have it. So a week later, myself and the then botanist were in Cooktown with 20 Indigenous rangers doing, you know, land management training.
And the rest is history?
And the rest is pretty much history. Yeah, did it just snowball from there.
Yeah. So how long did you do that for, the training?
Oh, up until a couple of years ago.
Yeah, okay. So that's that was about 1991
somewhere
or something.
Somewhere there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So where did you go? What did you see? What did you used to do? What did it involve?
Lots of moving, lots of travel, lots and lots of travel and good organisation. I travelled all over Queensland. I worked in the Territory up through the Torres Strait. So there's not too many communities I haven't sort of worked in, really. It's been great. I mean, everywhere's different. Each place has got its own sort of special something about it. And it's just, I always said that when I retire, I'd like to go back to the places I've been as a tourist. You know, not as a worker, just go as a tourist and just spend some time. Because you don't get really the chance to spend a lot of time, you know, really checking things out because you're there to work.
Yeah. Well, I'm just sitting here, Louise, and I'm looking across here. There's a beautiful sea eagle. Can you see him?
Oh, yep.
And we saw
him. There's lots around.
We saw him yesterday. So we're sitting here on the banks of Janie Creek, and there's so much life going on around us. There's fish jumping out in the water, and you can hear them flipping and flopping.
The brog was all lifted off when I drove in this morning. It was just amazing.
Yeah. So they were just up the road there.
Yep, just a couple of K back there. It's beautiful.
And there's a gorgeous sea eagle, which has just flown through the clear blue sky today and landed in one of the mangroves across the creek.
Yep, you'd be just waiting for breakfast.
Try to get it before the croc does.
Well, that's right. So, you know, life's a bit of a competition, no matter what species you are.
So you came here to do, started coming here?
Training. Yep, about 7 years ago.
Yep.
And, yeah, did that for a few years and then got the opportunity to do some relief coordinating because the coordinator at the time was highly overworked. So I used to come in and do some training and some relief coordinating for her. And then she resigned and I applied and here I am.
And here you are.
Mm.
So just going back to the training, so when you're training rangers, what do you train them in? Can you tell us a bit about what the training involves?
It's usually a certificate in originally it was like horticulture and stuff like that, but nowadays they call it conservation land management, which involves everything pretty much from OH&S through to, you know, chainsaws and quad bikes and, you know, species ID, weeds. It's really broad.
So when you're, I mean, it's one thing to have that piece of paper that says that you're a trainer, but you can't just train these things without having that knowledge and
that's
those
right.
skills yourself.
Yeah.
Because these are really, some of these skills like working with chainsaws, they're pretty, can be quite dangerous if you don't
Risky,
do
they call it?
Yeah, that's
can
the word.
Be risky.
Yeah, can be a bit risky. And even, I would imagine, you'd need to know those plants and trees.
And you do, and
so
that's the thing.
How did you pick up all of that knowledge along the way?
Well, just exactly that along the way by, you know, because I've had the chance to work with some really clever people. Sort of one of my things in life is that you always surround yourself by people that are smarter than you. because that's how you get better and that's how you learn, and that's mostly, you know, just through doing things that you pick up the skills, get the call for it, and then you can train others. Because, and to have the experience, it's just, I mean, again, it's one thing to have the piece of paper, but you've got to have some experience. Most people really want to learn. I mean, the sort of school or the room side of things, nobody's real keen on sitting in a room, but that's sort of a necessary evil, that's part of it. But mostly it's out in the bush, it's out on country, it's doing stuff, and you know, people respond to that really well.
So can you tell us again, just go through some of the modules that people would learn when they're doing that, getting that qualification?
Occupational health and safety, chainsaw, plant ID, weed management, you know, sort of species ID, you know, working with particular individuals, anything sort of biodiversity.
And what's the day in the life of the Mapoon Land and Sea Coordinator?
Varied. Well, the thing about ranger work is you never quite know what each day is going to bring. So I think one of the biggest things you've got to be able to do is be flexible. Because you can, you know, we've all got plans. We've all got, you know, like yearly plans, sometimes multi-year plans, you know, monthly plans, daily plans. But again, things happen on country. So sometimes the plan just zip. You've got to go do whatever's happened. You know, somebody might report something, so you've got to go and address that. So it could be anything from, you know, working out budgets to rescuing a turtle, or trying to figure out why there's a dead croc on the beach, or, you know, it could be anything. Or just talking to tourists.
Life in a remote community might be very far from what their life is. So just talking about things like working out why a croc is dead on the beach would be pretty bizarre for a lot of people. So.
Well, it is, but again, it's part of our natural landscape. We live with crocs every day. You know, we don't figure crocs as the enemy. I mean, they're entitled to be here. I actually personally love the fact that they're here. We've got one of the biggest nurseries in the southern hemisphere for crocs, just a couple of k up the river there. They're great, you know, and the community lives with crocs. I mean, we've never had any problems here. The old people never tell any stories of bad things happening because everyone's aware. You know, they're just a part of everything else that's here. So, you know, they need protecting, the same as any other cute little warm fuzzy critter.
This is My Cape York Life, available from capeyorknrm.com.au. Look for Land Manager and Podcasts.
We're with Louise Stone at Janey Creek, not far from Mapoon on the Western Cape York shoreline, looking out over the Gulf of Carpentaria. The area is a nesting site for two endangered turtle species, the Olive Ridley and the Flatback. During nesting season, the rangers spend most of their time on the beaches monitoring nests and tagging turtles. The beaches are absolutely beautiful here. It sounds like glamorous work, but I somehow don't think it is.
No, yeah, well, it does sound glamorous until you do it for a while. It just ends up being hot and heavy.
Hot and heavy and big days.
Big days, because it's day and night.
Yeah.
Even though there's a break in the afternoon, but, you know, you can never really rest properly in the afternoon because it's so bloody hot.
Yeah.
So, yeah, big days, and after a month, the whole crew's pretty well buggered.
Yeah. And, but you know, given that we're what a lot of people would consider remote, we've still got toilets and showers.
Absolutely. You know, the camp's great. We've got power, a generator,
yeah,
all of that.
Yeah.
And, you know,
it's pretty well set up.
That's right. If you're going to be out on a remote beach, you know, you don't have to live like an animal. You can still have, you know, a bit of luxury of home. Simple things like a generator and a stove and a fridge make all the difference.
Yeah, when you're doing those big days
on the beach. Yeah, because then people are happy to come out and do the work. You know, it's like home away from home, really.
Yeah, because you go out, so here they go out, they do two shifts during the day, don't they?
Yeah, they go out in the morning, you know, usually sort of 7 or 8 o'clock, depending. Spend the morning on the beach doing predation, seeing what's attacked the turtle nests, you know, checking footprints, doing all that sort of stuff. Sometimes digging up a nest to measure the eggs and, you know, get a sort of count of what's going on. And then come back, have a break, and then go out again at night time. Which is when the turtles come up onto the beach to lay. So we try and sort of find them as they're laying. You know, we can tag them if they're not already tagged, you know, do egg counts, all that sort of thing, measure them, and just do get a general idea of how the numbers are going, how the breeding season's going, whether we're, because both the turtles we have here are,
which are?
Olive Ridley's and the flatback are both on the, you know, the special list. They're in danger. So, you know, we sort of focus on that, and the scientists tell us that we need to have about 70% success with hatchlings to maintain a good, healthy population.
And you've got that here?
We do. Last year with the Olive Ridley's was a bit low, but from what I've seen this year, it's looking all right again.
Turtles are one thing, though, that you do. They're one of many, many things that you do as a ranger group. You also put in fires, you also do wetland surveys, you also count shorebirds.
Yep.
What are some of those things that you do? And what does, for instance, putting in a fire program?
Oh, well, it's not just like chucking a match out. We spend a lot of time doing planning. We're part of a carbon project, and this 2016 was our third year. It's been very successful. So there's a lot of planning going into it, and we try and do it sort of traditional way as well as, you know, white fella way, so a bit of both. And like I say, third year, it's been really, really successful. We're actually earning good credits off it. The rangers love the burning program. They just love it because they've sort of all turned into mad professors, really, because now they can actually see, like, last year's burn and the scar patterns, so they know where to burn or where not to burn. So it's really good, and it's they've really taken to it. It's great.
Yeah.
It's about preventing wildfires. So we put in what they call cool burns early in the season, in the hope that that'll stop any major fires in a really dry time. And if you do your cool burns right, like we try and create what they call a mosaic pattern, so even if in the late season a fire starts, it's really got nowhere to go because we've sort of fire patched all over the place.
And those big fires release that carbon into the air?
They do.
Carbon's one of the big contributors to
absolutely
global warming?
Yep, that's right.
Okay, so what are some...
Shorebirds. Shorebirds are great. We're very lucky here in Mapoon with our shorebirds. We do a count every year. We have done for several years now, and we're up over the 20,000 mark for migratory shorebirds a year come to visit.
That's pretty amazing.
It is.
Where do they come from?
All over. It's part of that flyway zone. You know how they migrate from up through the north, like northern hemisphere, back down to us.
So all over the world. We've got
all over the world.
Mapoon's a hot tourist destination for migrating birds.
They love it. They come here and rest before they move on, because up north further there's so much destruction and habitat sort of loss going on. A lot of times they can't even stop at places where they used to stop, so they've got to keep flying. And because we're sort of right up the north of Australia, we're one of the first sort of sanctuaries, I guess, they can get to land and rest and fatten up a little bit before they move on and do the next journey. So, you know, 20,000 a year is very cool. I mean, there'd be more, but we can only count over sort of a week. I don't know whether you can imagine, but counting flocks of thousands of birds is difficult.
Yes, so that was going to be the next question. So what does a bird count involve? That must be...
It involves crazy people with binoculars and scopes set up on a really hot beach for days on end, just watching birds and counting.
Right.
Yeah. And your eyes hurt and your back hurts and your head hurts. But it's great. When you get a result like 20,000, you think, yeah, that's pretty cool. So we've put in an application to try and become a part of that flyway network zone. It's recognition, it's a world recognition of the importance of the site. It doesn't necessarily add any legal protection, but it is a useful tool if you're going to be negotiating with mining companies, etc., if they want to come and do what they do anywhere near the area that you're trying to look after.
And I guess, as you were saying, as more and more habitat in other places of the world is lost, these places like Mapoon, where you've got, you know, which is pretty good nick, really.
It is. We're very lucky. It's beautiful. Yeah, we don't really have too many problems, even with weeds and stuff like that. We're very lucky.
Okay.
We don't have a lot of nasties.
So weeds can be... Weeds are a major problem across the whole of Australia.
Absolutely.
But not so much here.
Not so much because, again, it's only a very small community, and until sort of recently, we haven't had a lot of sort of tourist numbers coming in, or sort of fairly low numbers. I guess the weed problem now is with horses, because we have horses around the place that they sort of carry the weed around.
So these
weed seed.
Horses, I mean, horses across the country, people are just thinking, might be thinking normal horses, but these aren't, these are ferals, aren't
No,
they?
These are wild horses.
Wild
yeah.
horses, yeah. Yep, so they're not natural to this country?
Not at all.
And they're not looked after?
No, they're not managed at all.
Yeah.
No.
So, and they chew the native vegetation, right?
Well, they do, they damage the swamps.
What kind of damage do they do?
Well, swamps, a lot of damage to swamps because they get in and they sort of mess all up. They'll get into drink, but, you know, because they're the cloven hoof thing, it damages the banks of the, you know, swamps and wetlands, places like that. And again, if there's weed seed, they'll pick it up in their tail or their mane, you know, because they're, like I said, they're unmanaged, so they'll wander from swamps, you know, through town. So, you know, there's no sort of control yet.
So why,
try and minimise that.
Louise, why do you think, why do we, one of the million-dollar questions in natural resource management, why do we need to control weeds?
Because if we don't control weeds, we won't have this beautiful environment that we're staring at right now.
Yeah. So what are they?
Because
doing?
Weeds will take over. Weeds are, you know, you've got to love a weed, to be honest. their whole purpose is to survive and reproduce. So a weed will grow a lot quicker than a native species. It will set a whole lot more seed than a native species. And it'll germinate in a lot less time than a native species. And mostly with weed, it'll be not just an individual, it'll be a patch of them, which just gets bigger and bigger. Whereas our poor old natives struggle, you know, they're slow growers mostly. Yeah, so weeds are the enemy.
Mm. So what weeds do you have here? What are the problems here?
There's a bit of lucina, but it's not too bad. We don't have anything like the giant rat's tail grass or anything like that. We've got a bit of what they call joint vetch, which kind of looks like a sensitive weed, but it's not a sensitive weed. It's an upright one, but it's got that same sort of leaf pattern on it. So it's pretty good.
Yeah, okay, that's lucky.
Very lucky.
And
we want to try and keep it that way.
So one of the ways of getting rid of some of that weed too is fire. That's another reason
exactly.
you're burning?
Yep, that helps. It all helps.
Other programs that we might have here? And what else are you doing in Mapu?
Well, we're just about to leap into sea grass monitoring.
Okay, so why do you do that?
Because the turtles and the dugong eat it.
So you've got a...
seagrass beds.
Well, obviously, big turtle population here, but also dugong here.
There is dugong here, and fairly healthy numbers. We don't have an exact number. Trying to do research with dugong is a bit tricky. You can either do it by air or by a boat. Neither of which is. You've got to use a fixed wing aircraft, which is very, very expensive, etc. And there's all sorts of rules with Cassiter, how close you can go.
Because they're a bit shy, aren't they?
They are very shy. And if you go out in a boat. What they do down south is they all leap up the boat and sling one. I thought, that's not going to happen here.
No.
Because the croc will get you first. You won't have to worry about the dugong. So, yeah, a little bit more planning there, I think, before we figure out how we're going to go about it. But the population, you know, with what we see when we're out on patrols and it looks pretty good.
Okay. For people who've never met a dugong, they're pretty cute. They're pretty interesting.
Well, they call them sea cows. They are. They're a strange-looking animal. They're like a big slug in a way with tail and fin, but it's amazing sort of head and these big lips on them. They're funny-looking creatures.
And they're mammals?
Mm.
And they live in the ocean?
Yes.
Yeah. And they graze?
They graze grass. They eat grass.
So they eat
herbivores.
They like turtles and they eat this, except that seagrass is their main food, isn't it?
Yeah.
Whereas turtles can eat other things.
That's right. Oh, yeah, that's right.
So healthy seagrass communities are pretty important.
They are, because we've got a couple of seagrass beds around Mapoon in various places. And, you know, we monitor that. It's tricky because you've got to get absolute the lowest tide you can get so we can get out onto the, you know, the sand to have a look at it. And we identify what species of seagrass it is, you know how thick it is, et cetera, just to make sure that there's enough there for the dugong. And it's one of the cutest things is when you're monitoring seagrass, you can see the pattern where the dugong's been, like where he's been feeding, because they'll just feed in a line. And then they say the next day the dugong will come back to that exact same spot and keep going, just keep feeding off that same line.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, amazing. But it's funny, you see all these sort of little tracks through the seagrass beds. It's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, there's animals around. It's nice.
And Louise, we've also, around Mapoon, I've been very lucky, I think, because I've spent a bit of time up here with the rangers, and I've been lucky to get out to some of the beautiful wetlands that are around, and you do programs?
We do. We monitor. We've got 9 priority wetlands that we monitor and manage and care for. So 4 times a year, each of them we go out and we'll do a health assessment on them. Water quality, we test water quality, not just in the wetlands, but all our rivers as well. So we're really trying to monitor everything, you know, to keep an eye on everything. So if there's a change, then we can hopefully fix it before it gets out of control. And the other thing with the monitoring of wetlands and water quality is, you know, we're surrounded by mining. So it's really important we keep an eye on what's going on, so that if there is any change, we can do something about it.
So Louise, you've given us a pretty good overview of the kinds of work that you do. So can you tell us a little bit about the rangers? Who works for Mapoon Land and Sea Rangers?
The rangers are local, Indigenous people from Mapoon. That's who they are. We employ locally only. So all of our rangers belong here. It's their country. And, you know, they love the opportunity to be out on country and doing something about caring for it and looking after it. They're very proud of what they do. And, yeah, and I'm proud of them for doing it because they're a great bunch of people. You know, again, you know, you've got to deal with all sorts of personalities and any group. You know, we're sort of an eclectic bunch of people, but it works. We all get along. It just works. So that's good.
And I've seen a couple of the rangers that you've had, I've known since in the few years that I've been working up here too. And just I've seen these amazing young people like Edwin who have just grown and
absolutely they do
these really amazing young leaders for their community too.
Well, part of my thing is, or what I believe is, it's not just about growing rangers. What we do here, or what I do here, is not about just growing rangers. It's about growing people as well. So you deal with all sorts of things. It's not just their work life. You know, they will ask you for assistance with other things in their life, and that all adds to, you know, getting them to be a better person. And like you say, you know, people grow, people step up. That's exactly what we want to happen.
Yeah, yeah. Lovely, because, I mean, it's a, you know, it's not a big place, Mapoon, is it? How many people?
On a good day, maybe 260, 270.
260.
Yeah, and that's a good day.
That's not 260,000.
No.
That's 260.
Individual, that's right. Yeah. I think the last, or we've just had a census, but the previous one was about 270 or something.
Okay. And can you tell us where is Mapoon in relation to the rest of Australia?
Okay. So, well, we're up Cape York, on the western side of Cape York, on the Western Cape. And Mapoon is about 80-odd kilometres north of Weipa.
And so it will be another 200 or so to the tip?
Yeah, from Tobermuga, yeah.
Yep. So you can do that. People do that by boat.
Absolutely. They do. It's hilarious. Yeah. But, yeah, good on you.
Yeah. And so Weipa then is... Oh, it's another 800 kilometres or 900 kilometres from Cairns.
Yeah. So from Weipa to Cairns, depending on who's driving, it can be, you know, 10 to 12 hour drive.
Yeah. And so for you guys to have a weekend away in Cairns for the weekend?
Yeah, no. No, not often. One, I mean, if you drive down, you spend 2 days driving, so that kind of defeats the purpose. And if you fly down, it's very expensive. So, you know, you don't really go to Cairns unless you have to or you really want to.
Yeah. And, I mean, why would you when you live in a beautiful place like this anyway, really?
True.
But you're living in a community of 260, 270 people. You're working with these people every day. You must know everybody in town. And, life in a small town...
Can be difficult.
Can be difficult. But it can also be, you know, it's... you're a long way from anywhere.
You are a long way from anywhere. I mean, I quite like living in small communities. That's how I grew up, I guess.
What's special about it?
It's small. Yeah, I mean, you don't have the big crowds. Like if there's 4 cars on Saturday morning, you're just whinging because, traffic. You know, it's silly things like that.
4 cars on a Saturday
morning. Yeah, that's just too much.
I heard your ranger coordinator actually saying to me, she goes, oh yeah, I'll have a sleep in on Saturday morning, and then 2 cars drive past. Bloody hell, can't they go?
And again, you get spoilt like that because that's the beauty of up here. It's the peace and quiet. That's why I like it. And it's small. You can have solitude, and I like solitude as well. That's, you know, part of the sanity, I guess, of living remotely. You don't necessarily know everybody in town, surprisingly. And you know, if you're not working, you might not even come across people. So,
How many hours a day are you working on a normal day? Big days?
It's hard to tell. If you include phone calls and things like that at night time, you know, you don't really stop working. You're just not at the office.
Yeah, I guess so. Probably what's life like in the community? Because you don't really have a lot of downtime, do you?
No, because everyone knows where you live. They know you're the coordinator and something's going on. They'll just come and see you or ring you up and expect you to fix it or make it better or something, which is fine. You know, that's what we do. So you just call a couple of rangers, go, right, let's go.
So you've been up here in this part of the world for 7 years now?
Mapoon, yeah.
Somewhere along the way, not for probably another 20 years, I imagine, but you might retire one day.
Oh, don't do that to me. 20 years, no, I won't be doing this in 20 years' time.
What are you going to be doing in 20 years' time?
Oh, look, I'd like to be just sitting behind the steering wheel of my car, just driving around this amazing country and just having a look.
Yeah.
Just pottering along, no rush, no plan, just go and have a look.
And what would you like to see for the future of land management, land and sea management on Cape York?
I think for the Cape in general, you know, with tourists, I mean, the road's going to be bitumened in the next couple of years, or fully bitumened in the next couple of years. My concern is tourism, to be honest, and, you know, tourists don't bag me. But, you know, with tourism come a lot of other things, you know, like the rubbish, like the illegal fires, you know, like the bush tracks that shouldn't be there, you know, the destruction of habitat, etc., etc. That all comes with extra tourists. So I'd like that to be managed really well. And for tourists to just understand that this country is pretty special, and if you bugger it up, you're not going to get it back. Once it's gone, it's gone. So it's got to be done properly from the beginning. People.
So, look, it's been lovely having a chat with you here in this beautiful spot, this very, very special spot on Cape York.
It is.
See,
that's the thing about Mapoon, everywhere's beautiful. We care for 183,000 hectares of land here, and there's just everywhere we go, it's a lovely spot. You know, and I guess some people might not think that, but we see, I guess, this country in a different way than a lot of other people would.
And I've got to say that someone who keeps coming back here looking for excuses to come back, yeah. I 100% agree with you.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's beautiful.
Louise Stone, thank you for having a chat with us this morning.
Thanks, Lyndall.
Louise Stone, former Land and Sea Coordinator at Janie Creek near Mapoon on Western Cape York Peninsula. If you've missed any previous episodes, find them and share them from your favourite podcast app or stream live from our website, Cape York Land Manager. Next time on My Cape York Life, Peter and Annette Marriott on raising cattle, building roads, introducing helicopter mustering and double-decker trucks to the Cape.
We're on a 9,000 acre property just north of Lakeland.
We've got our cattle on here. We've basically got Brahman cattle and we've crossed them over with some Charolais and have virtually set it up that we can do it very easily for mustering, very easy maintenance.
I came up as a manager in 1970. I was 19, and it looked like the place to make some money.
We worked out long ago that if we wanted to do any improvements at all on the property, we had to get some sort of off-farm income. So Peter and I have basically been in earth moving since 1993, and we've done a lot of work in a lot of different places, building dams, roadworks, fencing.
You're going to make your fortune in cattle.
45 years later and nearly there.
I'm Lyndall Scoble from Cape York Natural Resource Management, and I'll see you next time on My Cape York Life.